Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, Curdies and Potties. Welcome to Linnell on Radio National. I'm not into gastro porn, and I never go to posh restaurants. So why have I got a food writer on the program? Well, because he's a rather different food writer. He's the only food writer in the annals of history to win a Pulitzer Prize. And you'll find out why he was worthy of that when he pops in for a bit of a chat later in the program. Interesting bloke, Jonathan Gold. Sitting opposite me, wired to a lie detector, because I now require that of all my guests, is Dorothy Rowe. We're into lies in a big way. We had a bloke on the other night called Martin Jay about his book, The Virtues of Mendacity, which you can't get yet because it hasn't been published. We get it hot from the pre-presses. And Martin was sort of singing the praises of a good creative lie, particularly in the realms of politics. So I've decided from now on, every bloody guest has got to be wired up to a lie detector. And Tom Hall, who's our maitre d' on matters technical, has got this new app. He's got a new app, and every time anyone tells a lie in the program, you'll hear a loud electronic raspberry blurting. I think the program will become deafening from time to time, not with Dorothy, because she's saintly. But before I introduce Dorothy, I've got a couple of matters here I've got to talk to you about. Thank you, Graham Ward, for sending me a stern admonishment. Apparently, I said the other night, didn't mean to say it, that Australia doesn't call university chairs after people. What I always do is cross-examine American profs on the name of their chair, and some of them are quite embarrassed by the benefactor, because they tend to be rather dodgy businessmen. Paulette Goddard. We had a Paulette Goddard professor on one night. She was the wonderful co-star with Charlie Chaplin in some terrific movies. But a lot of them are, you know, a bit off. But Graham's let me know in no uncertain manner that, in fact, we have a lot of named chairs in Australia. Graham, I confess, from time to time, we get a named professor on, and I ask them their story as well as my American guests. And he writes about John Henry Challis, English-born in 1806, arrived in Sydney 1829, free settler by 1850, pastoral licence, 31,000 square kilometres. Wow. He returned to England, died in 1880, left legal instructions on the death of his wife that his fortune go to Sydney Uni, and in 1889, 200,000 smackers were handed over. Now, that's a hell of a lot of money. That's better than a poke in the eye with a burn stick. So we now have Challis chairs in law, international law, jurisprudence, anatomy, biology, civil engineering, Australian literature, history and philosophy. I was also taken to task by my dear friend, Professor Anne Edwards. Anne and I work together on TACSI, the Australian Centre for Social Inclusion, and she also had to remind me that I'd told a fib, but, you know, oh, hang on, that didn't get an electronic blurt? Good, I just got under the wire there. Now, here's another letter, also handwritten. This is from a Catholic priest mate of mine who was born in Croatia, and it's a lovely letter. He got here a bit late. It's a long time since I wrote to you. I was just running to let you know that this Wednesday is Ash Wednesday, the traditional time when Christians begin their Lenten fast. I usually fast by not listening to the radio, but I make one exception. I will listen to Late Night Live. I listen to it with relish. I wonder if that's a pun, like I listen to it with tomato sauce. Anyway, but that's not why I'm reading you the letter. I've just returned from Croatia, and I visited Mostar. You'd be interested to learn that in the Bosnian town of Tuzla, there is a soccer team of Catholic priests playing against a team of Muslim clerics, who mainly win as their better players. Oh, dear. Thank you for that. That's a delightful story, and I hope that Lent wasn't too harrowing, with or without relish. Okay, Gladys, last week, US academic Martin Jay talking about the virtues of mendacity, and we're following up today with another take on lying, this time from a psychological perspective. Dorothy Rowe, adorable woman, world-renowned psychologist and author. She's tackled subjects from our ideas about death to depression and sibling rivalry. Her new book, Why We Lie, will be published by HarperCollins very shortly. This is another book hot from the pre-presses. And Dorothy, wired up to the lie detector, joins me now in the Sydney studio. Welcome back, Dorothy.
I'm very happy to be here.
What's a lie, Dorothy? Define it for us.
A lie?
Yeah.
Well, I define it in my book as words or actions which are intended to deceive.
Or action. So it doesn't have to be expressed. It can just be done.
Well,
you can live a lie, in other words.
There are lots of lies of silence. We know something is happening or something is said, and if we were truthful, we would speak, but we don't speak. Families are full of lies of silence, particularly my family, where things weren't said.
I've just met your son. He seems remarkably honest.
Yes, indeed, indeed. I brought him up not to be like his.
Like the rest of them.
Yeah.
Do you have a moral position on lying? I don't think you'd have a simplistic view, would you?
I don't think in terms of some absolute good or an absolute evil. I think in terms of practicalities, how does it turn out, in the long run? And in the long run, lying doesn't turn out well, particularly when the lies are the lies you tell yourself.
They're probably the worst sort. I was saying the other night to my American friend that I often lie out of kindness. Gosh, you look wonderful. I've never seen you looking better to someone who's on the edge of death or things like that. That's okay, isn't it?
It's part of the oil that of society, that it would be unkind not to say those kinds of things.
So lying can be the good oil of society.
Yeah, but I think you need to be aware of when we do that, that it's not just that you being so virtuous and kind and generous and all that stuff, but we say white lies because we don't want the people we're saying them to dislike us or turn against us or get all upset and make a terrible mess of everything. We just want things to be calm and quiet and people like us.
Dorothy, I remember an amazing incident. It's at the Majestic Theatre in Melbourne. It's 100 years ago. It was the first week of 2001, The Space Odyssey. So I rock along to see this enigmatic Kubrick film. And a little boy and his mother are sitting just up the road. And a bearded lady came in and sat down. And I'm talking about a full, wonderfully combed beard on this woman. She may have been a professional, or she may just have been defiant about her follicular excess, but she sits down there. And the little boy looks at her, takes his eyes off the screen, and he says, "Mum, that lady's got a beard." And his mother gave him a hell of a belting on the ears. So he was punished for telling the truth.
Yes, yes. And that's why children learn very early to lie. I discovered a wonderful book by an American psychologist whose first name I can't pronounce, but her surname is Reddy, where she's studying with children under three how they really have a very keen understanding of what their family are thinking and feeling. But one particular chapter in the book is about how early children learn to lie. And all different kinds of lies, although the one kind of lie they don't say is a white lie. They haven't learnt about being kind to other people. They're like the little boy in your anecdote, that they're truthful. But there are a lot of bravado lies where there's one terribly sad story in there about the three-year-old girl whose mother tells a story about how this child, when a mother goes to beat her or beats her the child says didn't hurt. And that sort of lie.
Lie as carapace.
Yes. But, you know, when you're a child, you have to learn how to lie, because otherwise you've got to be completely obedient. Because if you're truthful and disobedient, you get punished.
Let's up the ante a bit to big and middle-sized lies, major political spinning or porky telling, because I know you have thoughts about the lies that were told in the lead-up to the Iraq War. And in the book, you talk about the effect it's had on Blair, who has been punished, as opposed to Bush and Cheney, who seem to have got away with it.
It's very curious, because I'm not, living in England, not in a position to actually see Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld up close in the way I live in the same country as Blair, and he's often in the news, and I see him.
And he makes himself available.
He makes himself available.
Which is to an extraordinary extent.
And of course, I've been able to study him. The wonderful thing about television and politics is you get such close pictures. You see the person's face, and you see emotions on the person's face that then they're not able to control. They're not aware.
You see what a poker player would call the tell.
That's right. Yes. And with Bear, I mean, it was pretty obvious that he's a people person. He needs people to like him. And he was very good at presenting himself in a way that we all liked him. And, of course, we all wanted to like him. We all, after Thatcher and Major, goodness. And in the middle of his time as Prime Minister, he went on to speak to a big conference of Women's Institute. It's like the Country Women's Association here. And he got up and he started to patronise these women, which was a big mistake. And they started to boo him. The cameras were right on him. And you saw he hadn't expected that these women wouldn't like him, and he really lost it. He didn't know.
He couldn't say didn't hurt.
He couldn't say that, and he couldn't get himself together because it was the worst thing.
Would you go further now? You think the Blair you see, we've seen on television a lot in the last week or so, as he's virtually on trial, you think he's on the edge of breaking up?
Well, I think what he did was, when it was obvious there were no weapons of mass destruction, and when his colleagues just said to him, "You're going to leave. We do not want you as Prime Minister." That was, to him, very devastating. And for people persons, extroverts, that is really the worst thing they fear the most.
Well, let's look at another form of political lie, and that was the most famous one recently. It was Clinton and Lewinsky. Now, his argument, or the argument of his supporters, was that it had nothing to do with him, his merit as a president. You argue that there's no separation between public and private.
Not in this. I mean, there really isn't, because what we do in private, the person that we are, we're that same person when we're in a public position. And the thing about lying is that if you don't do it very often, you're not terribly good at it, you don't develop the skills, and you don't produce a lie as the defence of first resort. Whereas you've always been lying. You grew up in a family where you learned how to lie to defend yourself, and you developed all the skills, and you were a quick to a lie, quick to think of what would be a good lie to say. You use that all the time because it's too useful.
Alan Nell, ABC Radio National, abc.net/rn. and my guest is the painfully truthful Dorothy Rowe, and we're talking about her upcoming book. I like that, upcoming book, Why We Lie. What about the GFC? You give that a psychological analysis because you think that lies and hubris were major ingredients.
The what?
The global financial crisis.
Oh, the,
that one.
I spell it out, the global financial crisis.
I have to use, you know, abbreviations because the program only goes for 50 minutes.
That's right. The global financial crisis in just when I was reading as what the various bankers, as we call them, were saying and doing, they were producing the kind of lie where we are denying something that we know. Now, denial is a very popular form of lies and comes in all sorts of ways. But there are things that we learn about the nature of the world very early on. And, you know, we learn, for instance, that nothing goes on forever. Everything either comes to an end or transmutes into something else. And there were the bankers and other financiers saying that house prices would continue to rise. Well, nothing does. And, of course, they stopped rising. There was another lie that was implicit in what they were doing, that it was in terms of the consequences.
But most of them seem to take the view that their personal actions would have limited consequences.
Yes. Well, that's a very foolish attitude. And again, it denies reality, because what happens is that there's the almost, we often refer to as the law of unintended consequences. Oh, dear, you know, that happens all the time, isn't it? That whatever we do has consequences, and we certainly don't know the full extent of those.
Well, now we do know the full extent of the consequences, and you and I both looked at the testimonies given by the chairman and the CEOs of the big US investment banks to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission in the US in January. What did you think when you were watching those gentlemen continuing to dissemble?
What was there was something more complex than just lying, that each of us lives in our own world of meaning, and we find it very difficult when we have to start to take on board ideas that are outside of that. But some people manage this task better than others. And I wasn't impressed with people who were there. They really, really were not understanding what was happening in the world.
I think there's a form of lying going on at the moment on climate change, a form, a depth of denial, which is tantamount to telling fibs. And it's almost as though people are in full retreat from this reality. Yes. Have you looked at that?
Oh, yes, indeed. But the essence of my book, because I always write about how we create our sense of being a person, what we call I, me, myself, that is created out of the ideas that our brain creates, you know, as we look around the world and such. And when our ideas are invalidated, they're proved to be wrong, the world isn't, all events show us, the things aren't the way we saw they were, we feel ourselves falling apart. You know, in the situation where you discover, say, that someone you thought you'd spend the rest of your life with has disappeared, or the job that was going to be your great future you've been sacked from.
And those the job that defined you too.
Yes, and that defines you. You have that feeling of falling apart. And if you understand yourself, then you know it's your ideas falling apart. But if you don't understand that, you feel it's you falling apart.
So some of the people who are most strident in their denial, who talk the big picture conspiracy theory, that everyone's involved in the great lie of the, you know, Sunday below the 20th century, they're dealing with helplessness?
Well, what they're dealing with is the terrible thing. Because if you... I've just started to read Clive Hamilton's book on recently published. I don't know whether you've interviewed him recently. But, you know, he's very straightforward. We are close. We have passed the point where we can really control the climate. We can't control the climate. We're in danger of reaching the tipping. And, you know, my only consolation is that I'm not going to be alive to see this.
Although, God, you're only 80, woman. Give us a break.
Yes, I know. It can last a lot longer.
The planet's going to collapse by next Thursday.
Yeah. But, you know, it is terrifying because everything that we know, everything that we take for granted, over the next years, we don't know how long, will gradually change. You know, for instance, the farmers down the Murray Basin, they had this wonderful farming, you know, productivity, wonderful. It's disappeared.
Yeah.
That, all of that. Yeah. And so it is so frightening that some people lack the courage to face it.
Do you think that we're hardwired to lie, that that's a part of our genetic inheritance?
Well, animals are, you know, the animals are certainly deceitful, and zoologists have found or done all sorts of studies that show that. I mean, I don't think we're hardwired, but I think it's one of the defences that we find, because it's so easy for us to think of a lie, because we're not entirely sure at any time what the truth is. And we've always got access to fantasies that we can turn into a lie.
Mm. So, do we try and stop lying or just live with this proclivity?
I think the important thing is to never lie to yourself about when you're lying. You know when you're lying. And never lie to yourself.
Well, that's a point I made to the guy the other night, that I've watched politicians tell fibs and whoppers and porkies, but after a while they believe them. They say them often enough, and I think they'd pass a lie detector test after a few months.
That's right. I think if we're very clear with ourselves about the necessity to lie about something, and we always bear in mind that we are lying, we can lie quite effectively doing that. But if we start to tell ourselves that, yes, it's the truth, then it's hard, so hard to know what the truth is. And when we lie to ourselves, we make it impossibly
hard.
I've
never worked that out. Now, I'm going to ask you some questions. I don't want you to answer them. I'll see what the needle does on the lie detector. Are you Dorothy Rowe? Are you a world-renowned psychologist and author? Is your new book, Why We Lie, to be published by HarperCollins at the end of May? Totally truthful on all points. Dorothy, lovely to see you. Call in when you've written the next one.
Thank you.
Okay, my dear, that was Dorothy Rowe, one of my favourites. This is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. And Tom is going to play a little bit of a musical bridge while we rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. No, we're going to rearrange the chairs in our little restaurant, because I'm going to talk to a very fascinating food writer. One of the great mysteries of this program, which I know intrigues my beloved listeners, is how do we attract all these extraordinary people onto Late Night Live? Over the years, tens of thousands of the most interesting and eccentric people on the planet, and a few from distant galaxies. Well, we can't pay them. I don't know how the producers do it. But on this case, the reason this bloke's on is because I have lured him into into social intercourse by promising my secret recipe for wombat souffle, wombat being one of the very few meats he hasn't eaten. 2 years ago, Jonathan Gold became the first food critic ever to win a Pulitzer for his restaurant reviews in LA. Now, what made that all the more mind-boggling was that Jonathan doesn't write for the New York Times or Vogue, but for LA Weekly, a free alternative newspaper, where he documents the infinite complexities of LA's cultural shifts through the widely diverse restaurant scene. Now, his job has taken him to some of LA's best and worst neighbourhoods, because unlike most food critics, he doesn't just review the high end, he also makes it his mission to discover and eat at hole-in-the-wall joints, where he's occasionally ended up with food poisoning. He's eaten food that most wouldn't touch, tasted things that many would die to be able to eat. Now, his book, Counterintelligence, published in 2000, is a collection of his best columns, is seen by many native Los Angelians as the finest existing guide to the city. Jonathan's ability to weave music and politics and art and philosophy into reviews of a taco joint have led to fans dubbing him variously the S.J. Perelman of food writing and the Thom Yorke of criticism. And he joins me today from Los Angeles, and he's got bronchitis. Jonathan, here's a packet of Fisherman's Friends. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
If you don't feel well during the program, don't hesitate to let us know. How did you happen? What are the principal ingredients in you? A bit of family background, if you please.
Nothing very exotic, I suppose. My mother was a high school librarian in a inner city neighborhood for many years, and my dad was a probation officer. So, I suppose she taught him, and he put him in jail.
I've never had anyone whose father was a probation officer on the program before. We're off to a flying start here. I understand that you've had a girlfriend whose parents were from Taiwan.
Well, that was many, many years ago when I was in high school. I've been married for 25 years. I think I probably first got interested in food in a big way when my girlfriend's mother, who was the head of physics at the college she taught at, was also a fantastic cook, and she'd come home and cook four courses every night. And I would be there every day dutifully at dinner time. And after a while, I was, I think, much more interested in her mother's cooking than I was in the girl, but I kept it going for a couple of years.
Now, Jonathan, before you shoved your knees under many a restaurant table, I believe you used to clamp your thighs around a cello.
Yes, I thought I was going to be a musician when I grew up, and I studied cello and conducting and composition. And, you know, one thinks that when one leaves conservatory that the world is going to be clamoring for your string quartets, and unfortunately that's so rarely the case.
Yes, I found it so. Do you still play the cello for rest and recreation?
Sure. I'll play Bach a couple times a week. I'll play scales. I love being able to play the cello. And my daughter is becoming quite good, so I have to at least stay enough ahead of her that she will respect me.
But you're a person of extremes. You then formed a punk band.
Right.
And this led you to Rolling Stone, I understand, where you became a not inconsequential writer on matters musical.
I'm not sure it was direct, but I'm not sure I'd ever listened to a rock and roll record. I played Baroque music chiefly, and along with the contemporary stuff. And somebody took me to a concert at the Mask, which was the first punk rock club in Hollywood underneath the porn theater on Hollywood Boulevard. And I looked at the people with, you know, safety pins through their cheeks, jumping up and down to the walls, trying to destroy everything in the club. And it occurred to me, wait, you can do this? It was marvelous.
It sounds like some of them might have been intent on eating you. So how did you make the transition to writing about eating other things?
Oddly enough, I'd made my living by writing about legal matters. I'd worked for a law newspaper right out of college, and I started writing, working as a low-level editor and writing about law for and music for the LA Weekly. And one week, they needed somebody to edit the restaurant issue, and they asked me if I'd do it, and I turned out to be good at it. And I haven't looked back.
I understand that as an experiment, you decided to eat at every restaurant along a particular boulevard. Tell us about this undertaking.
It was when I was still working at the legal newspaper and bored out of my mind. There's a street in Los Angeles called Pico, which it's the back porch to Los Angeles. It's working class among its entire length. So started downtown where it dead ends into a Coca-Cola bottling plant and ate at a Salvadoran restaurant and systematically went down the 14 miles of the boulevard until I made my way to the chili stand at the beach.
14 miles. And, of course, given that there are, 26,000 licensed places to eat in L.A., I guess there were quite a lot along Pico Boulevard.
Yeah, there were. And it was an interesting time in the history of Los Angeles. It was in the earliest 80s when President Reagan had rather enthusiastically poured money into wars in Central America. And suddenly, 100,000 to 150,000Central Americans decided they were going to, come up to Los Angeles to visit their cousin Jorge, and they never left. And it was being able to see a neighborhood and being able to see specific Los Angeles cultures as they form. Not just seeing that an El Salvadoran restaurant was different from a Nicaraguan restaurant, was different from a Honduran restaurant, but realizing that restaurants owned by people of different political factions were quite different. That
you mean you could distinguish right wing from left wing food?
It's mostly by the heaps of newspapers that they had in the corner,
right?
And the right wing ones tended to wear suits and glower, and the left wing ones.
Well, of course, what you're now revealing, and one of the attributes, one of the most charming attributes of what you actually do, the way you weave in politics and music and art into your writings on food. And, for example, there was that moment in 1992 during the Rodney King riots in LA that you decided to write about places in the affected areas.
That was interesting. I was at the Los Angeles Times at the time, writing a weekly restaurant column for them. And I didn't tell anybody I was doing this. I sort of waited for them to figure it out, and I'm not even sure that they did. But for several weeks in a row after the riots, even when the fires were still burning, I wrote about restaurants that were, as you say, in the affected neighborhoods. I've always thought that one of the things that I could do with my column, possibly the best thing I could do with my column, is to get people in Los Angeles to be a bit less scared of one another, to be able to deal with each other on a human level rather than demonizing them. And the thing about restaurants is it's always an open door into a culture.
Look, nothing does it better than food. You're broadcasting to a country which had a white Australia policy for much of the last century. But despite our paranoia about our Asian neighbours, we embrace the Chinese restaurant. And there's not a village or town, let alone a suburb in this country, that doesn't have one or three. And it does begin, doesn't it, to break down bigotry.
It's much harder to see somebody as the other when you're sitting and joking with them and eating their food and seeing their kids watch TV in the corner.
Yes.
It's part of the family.
I understand that you also focused on Muslim restaurants during the lead-up to George W.'s war in Iraq.
That was another thing I thought was important. I mean, I know Sydney is actually blessed with many restaurants of... I mean, it's an incredible restaurant city. But Los Angeles is big enough and has big enough communities of different sort of people that I was able to do a Muslim restaurant every week for, again, a couple of months. And people didn't even realize that they were Muslim restaurants, really, because one was a Thai restaurant, one was a Kentucky Fried Chicken that just happened to be halal. One was a, you know, traditional Lebanese place. One was Iranian. I mean, they were, most of them weren't what you would automatically think of as Muslim at all, yet they all were, and they all had the same heritage, and they all had certain things in common.
You've got a reputation as the bloke who documents a kind of scavenger cuisine, innards and crickets and bear paws. But that's not entirely correct, is it? Because you also review the high-end restaurants as you did for Gourmet.
Yeah, I've always written about both sorts of restaurants. Los Angeles has a very good sort of posh restaurant scene. Some of the restaurants here, such as, you know, Spago, are world famous, and rightly so. You can come here and eat very well with a platinum card. And more
do you have a platinum card, Jonathan?
Oh God, no.
But they still let you in to platinum card sort of restaurants, yeah.
They do. It would be interesting. It was more interesting when I was doing this sort of thing in the 80s and I was still in my punk rock phase, and I looked very different from anybody else who was in the restaurant.
Well, you still do look different from most other people in the restaurant, because I've actually looked at photographs of you, and that raises the issue that, of course, if you were working in Manhattan, you'd have to go through that nonsense of trying to disguise yourself. But that'd be a bit difficult for you. And I guess you're now, you know, now that you're a celeb, everyone knows who the hell you are when you walk through the door.
I hope they don't. I always do, because they really can't make the food any better. I wish they would. And as if you've been doing this long enough, you realize that the difference between being recognized and not being recognized isn't that you suddenly get stellar food and stellar service. It's the equivalent of seeing a movie with the director sitting in the row behind you, tapping you on the shoulder, saying, "This is the good part right here. No, pay attention, pay attention." You know, or conversely saying, "Wait, I have three kids at Cornell. Do you realize how much that costs?"
I have the experience of sitting with many a film director over the years. I know how agonizing that is. And when the lights come up, the best thing to do is to turn around and say, whatever his name is, "You've done it again," or "Only you can do it." Something a bit ambiguous like that.
That is foolproof, yes.
I commend that to you. Now, you don't like the word ethnic to being applied to restaurants because of ghettoizes people. You use, or prefer, I understand, vernacular or traditional cooking.
Right. I think ethnic food is implying that, you know, you are the mainstream culture and they, whoever they are ethnic. And especially in Los Angeles, we're all ethnic. We're definitely a majority-minority city. And there are cuisines that are art cuisines where somebody is taking what's available to them and the traditions available to them and sort of synthesizing it into something, you know, artificial and sometimes quite wonderful. Or there is traditional food in which they're cooking the food that their grandmothers cooked. And I love them both.
But so you like the creativity of hybridization as well as traditional purity?
If it's well done. If it's poorly done, and there was a period in the 1990s where chefs were realizing that they were supposed to be including these ethnic flavors and ethnic structures into their foods, but they'd never experienced them because chefs don't get out much. They're in their kitchens 18 hours a day if they're any good. And so they were reading books or somebody was telling them about them. And the idea of making a bowl of Thai noodles at a high-end restaurant when, in fact, you've never tasted a proper bowl of Thai noodles used to enrage me.
Mm. You haven't felt the same need to wander the world as others because, as you as you're explaining, the world is there at your footstep, at your doorstep.
Oddly enough, that's true. And I travel enough. I mean, I end up in, you know, Europe a couple times a year, chiefly Italy, and, you know, Asia probably once a year, Latin America maybe once a year. But it hasn't been the same round of, you know, if it's Thursday, it must be Paris, that a lot of my compatriots seem to have.
Can I confess that I am sometimes very queasy reading what might be described as gastro porn? I find the degree of the way we fetishize food is a bit of a worry. And what makes your stuff much more edible is that it is the cross-referencing. It is the way you bring in all sorts of what other people would regard as side issues, but your columns really mix things up.
Well, thank you very much. I like to think that I write about eating much more than I write about food. I mean, this sort of gynecological description of what might be in a dish, to me, it's uninteresting. It lies dead like as a flounder on the page. there has to be some of it, and it's a tool in the quiver. The most meaningful letter I ever got, I think, was back when I was at the LA Times. And I got a letter from a man in an AIDS hospice who said that he had his stomach removed and he, because of the HIV, and he couldn't eat, and that his experience of food every week was reading my column. And he thought that I did the job adequately, that was enough to at least make him be able to pretend that he'd eaten. And to be able to do something like that is wonderful.
It verges on the miraculous, and I should inform the Pope about this. We should have you made the first secular saint of food. Now, there's an interesting point you make about being able to follow civil strife in other parts of the world by the timing of new restaurants opening in L.A. What's happening at the moment?
Well, at the moment, we're seeing, I think possibly for the first time in American history, we are seeing Chinese chefs move back to China because they can make more money than they can make in the United States. That, to me, that's astounding. And they're mostly the chefs from the southern regions, from, you know, Hong Kong and from the Cantonese areas, and who are trained in high-end cuisine, but still there's that movement out. And what we have in at the moment are people from the very north of China, you know, Mongolia and around Harbin and Shandong and those areas. And you could definitely tell which part of China has become wealthy enough to emigrate but poor enough that they feel that they have to emigrate.
I bet there'll be a few Haitian restaurants opening up in the not too distant.
I suspect so. We've only had one Haitian restaurant in town, which unfortunately just burned down last week. That was very unfortunate.
Showing empathy for the homeland, perhaps.
Yeah, he'd had dozens of benefits for Haiti in the weeks since the earthquake, and it's tragic. Maybe his ventilation system couldn't handle the extra strain, something. It's not like right after the 9/11, one of the three Afghan restaurants in town was firebombed. That was a bit more directed, I think.
You've mentioned Sydney, so clearly you've been to Australia, although you didn't come and sample my wombat dishes.
I hear your garlic is extraordinary.
It's fantastic. When was your last trip here?
I'm ashamed to say I haven't been since 1994. And I've only been on rock and roll tours, so one's experience of the country when traveling with the Ramones is necessarily different than it would have been if I had been doing food and wine sorts of things.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your sort of bungee jumping food stuff. I'm thinking about the dangerous things or the wildly improbable things that you have masticated. Can you tell us a few of them?
I'm not big on the idea of stunt eating. I mean, I think you eat things because they're delicious, not because they're you're going to impress your friends. But the ones that seem to impress people the most are, I suppose the live animals. The Koreans like to eat live invertebrates a lot. Some of which are disconcerting because you're eating, you know, bits off of a live halibut while the halibut's, you know, looking up at you saying, I needed that. And parts of which, like, they'll do prawns where they'll strip away the carapace and they'll leave the head and that little bit of the tail. And you dip it in wasabi and you pick it up and you essentially kill it with your teeth. And a prawn isn't an intelligent animal, but it knows when it's being eaten.
Any time I've ever eaten anything alive, apart from oysters, was in Japan, where we ate something called ebi, which is very like the Australian term for yabby, which were little crustaceans which were wandering around the plate, but they doused them in sake or some sort of Japanese whiskey. So at least their emotional responses were somewhat dulled. But I do hold to the view that it's better to eat creatures which have stopped wriggling.
Yeah, at least they die happy. The one dish here that I find myself unable to stay away from is a thing called sadnakji, which is a Korean dish where they dispatch the octopus and they cut the tentacles into bits, and then they serve the bits to you on a plate with the dipping sauce of sesame oil with a little salt, and you dip it into the oil, and you learn very quickly that you're dipping it less for the taste than for the fact that it will keep the suckers, which are still very much active, from sticking to the back of your throat if you swallow them.
Now, isn't it interesting? Here you show this extraordinary courage in the face of the improbable, but you're a coward when it comes to scrambled eggs.
Explain
yourself.
I do blame myself. It's a food prejudice that I can remember the onset of. I think my first physical memory is of looking at my mother and saying, "Mother, I have just eaten my last egg." I must have been all of two or three, but I've stuck to it more or less.
Well, you've got to make room for smelly tofu, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Smelly tofu's bad too, but it's okay once you get past the smell, but that's asking an awful lot.
Dear, oh dear. And you're still with the free paper?
I'm still with the free paper. You know, things are contracting, as you've obviously heard, in the American journalism business.
And here. Yeah. Make no mistake.
But, you know, I like the weekly. I've been here a while. I've worked at big metropolitan dailies. I've worked at the poshest food magazine in the world.
What's that?
Gourmet Magazine.
Oh, that one. I thought Gourmet had gone belly up.
Gourmet did go belly up. I suppose what was the poshest food magazine in the world. It was a shame, really. Our circulation was growing. It was the biggest that it had ever been. We had devoted readers. You know, sort of like when you're listening to rock bands, there's the band you'll put on, you'll nod to, and you'll like it. And then there's the band who you'll consider tattooing his name into your skin. And Gourmet was the latter. They were the people who liked Gourmet, really liked Gourmet. But unfortunately, on the advertising side, it had become a luxury lifestyle magazine, and luxury lifestyle is exactly the thing that got...
Well, it survives here. You know, the spin-off, the Australian version, survives and perhaps even thrives. But I like the fact that you work for a free paper. There's a business model which may survive the advertising downturn.
Yeah, you can't say we charge too much for it, that's for sure.
And are you still having fun after all these years, Jonathan?
Yeah, I suppose it's like a theater critic. Every time he goes into a theater, he has to hope that, you know, when the curtain raises, he's going to see the best thing he's ever seen in his life. And every time I walk into a restaurant, I'm just hoping to be not knocked backward by something that I eat.
And being a theatre critic was one of my very first jobs in journalism half a century ago, and I don't think I might have gone into theatres with that hope, but I often left early, those hopes dashed. I'm very impressed with your ability to run this marathon.
Oh, thanks very much. I knew when it was that exactly the time to hang it up when I was in a rock and roll rider, which was being, you know, on the road with some band, and you know, listening to them vent and actually saying, "Oh, your poor parents," and you realize that when you're sympathizing with the parents instead of with the band, it's time, in fact, to get another line of work.
Well, Jonathan, I know that Counterintelligence was first published in 2000. Is it still in print? I sincerely hope so, because I'm just about to plug it.
Yes, it's definitely still in print. It's a good read. I think people will enjoy it.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you, and thanks very much for coming on. Jonathan Gold, food critic extraordinaire. His book, Counterintelligence, is still in print, and you should get it. The pages, in fact, are edible. It's a publishing breakthrough. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Now, before you go out and eat something disgusting, I'd like you to know that on our next program, we look at open government. Governments, especially new ones, like to promise openness, but the commitment tends to wane in office, and we'll be discussing the ideals, the risks, the realities of open government. That's it for now. Stick around for the news on Radio National. See you later.
G'day, Paul Barclay here from Australia Talks. Nanotechnology is changing the way we live. We're talking about things that are fabricated with tiny particles the size of an atom. They can improve food production, medicine, and commercial devices. But do we fully understand the implications? Listen now or download as an MP3 podcast from the Radio National website at abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Australia Talks.